Our next speaker is Tony Goldberg, who, as you can see on the sheet, is from the School of Veterinary Medicine and the Department of Pathobiological Sciences. I didn't do this for everyone, but I thought Tony's pedigree was interesting enough that I would just tell you it very quickly. Tony has bachelor's degrees in biology and English from Amherst. Then he went to Harvard and got his PhD in anthropology. That wasn't enough schooling, so he went on then to get his doctorate in veterinary medicine and a master's degree in epidemiology. So Tony is a well-rounded, interesting guy. He studies the ecology, epidemiology, and evolution of infectious diseases. He uses both field and lab methods to work on questions of how pathogens are transmitted among hosts across landscapes and over time. So today he's going to tell us about the West Nile virus, real-time evolution with real-world consequences. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's a very great honor to be talking to you on the 200th birthday of the anniversary of Darwin's birth and the 150th anniversary of the publication of On the Origin of Species. And I'm going to be talking today about West Nile virus as an example of evolution in real time with real world consequences. We tend to think, and certainly Darwin tended to think, of evolution as a process that happened over millennia, that he needed to probe the fossil record to understand how it had happened. And yet, with some of the problems that face us today in terms of infectious disease, we're actually looking at much shorter time scales, so that the processes of evolution by natural selection, as Darwin envisioned them, are occurring all around us on an everyday basis. And that forms the basis of a lot of my understanding, at least, of health and disease in people and animals. So this is a drawing of a rather serious-looking Darwin, I think, in front of a beach ball-sized model of the AIDS virus that was published on the inside cover of a book called Evolution of Infectious Disease by Paul Ewald, published in 1996. I would strongly recommend it for those of you interested in this topic. And this is, of course, an anachronism, because Charles Darwin had no idea that viruses even existed. Viruses were discovered and characterized in the early 20th century, where, of course, Darwin did his work in the 19th century. And yet, I would argue it is testimony to the power of any scientific theory that it can be applied to systems that were not foreseen by its originators. And that, I think I'll show you today, is the case with viruses. Charles Darwin's ideas apply equally well to viruses as it did to some of the macroorganisms that... So Darwin's theories apply very well to viruses, and I could have chosen many viruses to talk about, including HIV, which has one of the highest rates of evolution of any organism on the planet. But I chose not to because of my own work on West Nile virus. I find West Nile virus fascinating, first of all, because it's just so small. It's only 1,500 bases in its genome, and that it actually has an RNA genome. Some viruses don't have any DNA at all in them. They carry their genetic information with RNA. And that's compared with the genome sizes of bacteria, for example, we just heard of, that are in the millions of base pairs, or the human genome, which is a little over 3 billion base pairs long. This is only 15,000 bases, tiny, and yet think of the problems that it causes us. This particular virus infects many species and causes encephalitis in birds, humans, horses, other mammals, and was only recently introduced into North America in 1999, in fact. So we have an excellent fossil record, if you will, in the medical literature. We know exactly when this thing came. Previously to that, it was only known as a sort of obscure virus from Africa, the West Nile region of Uganda, coincidentally, which is the other place in the world that I work, Europe and the Middle East. And it had come into Europe and the Middle East on occasion. But it spread rapidly throughout North America when it was introduced in 1999. And it now has a predictable seasonal cycle in the upper Midwest United States, right around here, that is known as amplification. And this is a representation of it. In the early season, about mid-May to the end of July, we have few mosquitoes and few preferred avian hosts, here represented by the most important one in our area, the American robin. And the virus is transmitted back and forth, and it sometimes spills over into animals like horses or into people like Governor Blagojevich. And then when, and I guess an epidemic of encephalitis is about the best explanation I can come up with for what goes on in Illinois politics. So. But as the season progresses and the avian populations increase due to influxes of new birds and to growth in the population of mosquitoes, the rate of transmission of the virus and the amount of virus in the environment increases, and there's more spillover into people and other animals, which is why West Nile virus season in people happens in August to October. So this is called amplification. But it turns out that there is not just one West Nile virus. West Nile virus comes in two flavors, or came in two flavors in the United States, if you will. The original strain that landed in New York City area in 1999 and probably came from Israel via globalization and aircraft travel replicates in Culex pipiens, the mosquito that transmits the virus, approximately 2 days more slowly than this other strain of virus. And this other strain is called WN02, and it's called, that's West Nile 02 for 2002, which is a mutant version of this original 1990 strain that only appeared at the very end of 2001. And that particular strain replicates in that same mosquito 2 days more quickly than the original strain. And there are some genetic differences between these two strains, but the critical one seems to be a single nucleic acid change that causes a switch from a uracil to a cytosine at position 1,442 of the viral genome, which is in the envelope gene. And that causes a phenotypic change in the rate of replication of the virus. And it's not difficult to imagine that those two variations, those two viruses, may differ in fitness. A small change to an organism can sometimes have competitive advantages for that organism. So the New York 99 strain in the Culex pipiens mosquito is less fit than the WN02 strain, which is more fit in that it replicates more quickly. So what might one expect to happen? This was a nice result published by some of my colleagues not too long ago. Essentially, this new strain of West Nile virus has entirely replaced the old strain throughout all of North America. You cannot find NY99, the original strain of West Nile virus, anywhere in the United States or North America anymore. By 2004, there was none of it left because it was outcompeted by the new mutant version WN02. And this graph just shows the proportion of isolates of each type of virus that were recovered from diagnostic labs that had been analyzing dead birds throughout the United States between 1999 and 2005. And you can see a very nice decline in this less fit strain and a very nice increase in this more fit strain. And if you can think of a better example of evolution by natural selection, I certainly can't. So mutation. Sometimes mutations can be advantageous. The story is this virus was introduced into New York in 1999. A very simple mutation occurred in the genome. This change from a U to a C at position 1442 that conferred a selective advantage on this WN02 strain. And we know why, because it allowed it to replicate more quickly in the North American mosquito vector, Culex pipiens. And this led to a replacement of this less fit NY99 strain by the fitter WN02 strain. So this is adaptation of a virus to a new environment, very much as Darwin might have imagined for finches, but here for an organism that he didn't even know existed. So I wanted to bring this a little bit closer to home and talk about my study area, which is Chicago. You may not realize that in 2002, just as this new strain of virus was replacing the old one, Illinois led the United States in the number of human West Nile cases, and Chicago and the surrounding areas were hotspots for viral transmission. And the Chicago area has remained a hotspot for West Nile in humans and birds, again, with peaks of infection in August and September. And if you plot out where these cases occur, this is a geologic map of the Chicago Lake Plain, you can clearly see two clusters, one up here in the Evanston-Skokie area, one down here in the Oak Lawn area. And my study group debated this endlessly and decided to focus our efforts down here in the south on the Oak Lawn area, despite my protestations because all of the good restaurants are up here. To give you some historical perspective, this is an interesting spot. In 1901, the New York Times referred to this part of Chicago as having dirty streets, filthy alleys, impure water that caused an epidemic of typhoid fever and malaria. In 1975, there was an outbreak of human St. Louis encephalitis, a very similar virus to West Nile, in that same area. And in 2002, of course, this is where we found all the West Nile virus outbreaks happening, and it's still a hotspot. So there's something about this hotspot that is conducive to arbovirus transmission. And ask me about it, I won't have time to get into it very much. But we decided to look at how the virus is adapting and evolving within that particular study area, this tiny little section of suburban Chicago, and we chose a number of field sites that differed in their ecology. Some were what we call residential sites, which are your typical suburban Chicago row house 1950s to 70s architecture, and some we called natural sites, which were cemeteries, parks, green spaces, and we decided to make some comparisons. And within the study area, we have documented this seasonal amplification. So this is the CDC week number. This peak is about early September. In each of the years that we've been studying this virus, we do see this peak in the infection rate in mosquitoes that we track. So this is behaving like we expect it to. And just to confirm the ecology of this virus, we've collected lots and lots of blood-fed mosquitoes and used DNA techniques to analyze what their blood meals were. And we found that for Culex pipiens, the vector of West Nile, 80% of these blood meals were from birds, 16% were from mammals, and 4% were from weird things like tree frogs. But by far, in Chicago and in the area around here, the most important bird for West Nile virus transmission, because it's preferred and it's very able to replicate the virus, is the American robin. And the most important mammal is the human. And as case in point, we published a paper not too long ago that we affectionately call the smoking gun mosquito paper, where we found some mosquitoes, some individual mosquitoes, that were West Nile positive and had blood meals that we could identify. And these are only the 2005 data, but the subsequent years have been the same. Most of the birds are American robins, and most of the mammals are humans from these mosquitoes that are West Nile positive. So we have this real transmission link. 83% of our mammalian blood meals have been human so far. So, what's going on in this little part of suburban Chicago? Well, with viruses, they're hard to measure their wing lengths or beak depths and things like that, so you really have to go straight to the genes, and we chose as our target a 1500 base gene that is the most variable in the genome. It's the envelope gene. If you think of a virus as a kind of a Sputnik-looking thing, the envelope gene would be the little spike sticking out that it uses to interact with its environment, which in this case is the cell of the host or the immune system of the host. So it's not surprising that that gene should be very variable because it has to adapt to changing immunity. And we generated lots of sequences from many birds and many mosquitoes from these different types of sites. And the interesting thing we found is just the remarkable diversity of the virus within small, small geographic scales. So if you look at just the genetic diversity at the gene sequence level of the virus within our little area of Chicago, it's really not very much different at all from the entire United States. So if you go into suburban Chicago and sample West Nile viruses, you find as much genetic diversity there as you will throughout the entire North American continent. But we find differences in diversity between different populations of hosts and insect vectors. So mosquitoes have more diverse viruses in them than do birds. And interestingly and paradoxically, mosquitoes from these boring residential sites, these row houses with impermeable surfaces and lawns, have viruses that are more diverse genetically than do mosquitoes from the natural sites where you actually find the greater diversity of bird species. And I'll give you our hypothesis as to why that's happening in a moment. But when Darwin was sailing around the Galapagos archipelago, he noticed a phenomenon whereby the farther he got away from certain islands, the more different certain birds looked, or there was differences associated with distance. We see the same sorts of things in a very fine local scale in the Chicagoland area with West Nile virus. So if we plot the similarity between viral sequences as a function of geographic distance apart, we find a declining trend. So viruses collected close to each other are similar, and viruses collected far apart from each other are different over a scale of only about 10 kilometers. So we're finding very fine scale isolation by distance here in a virus. Interestingly, it's sometimes hard to calculate the exact rate of evolution of an organism, but we know when we collected these mosquitoes. We were there with our backpack aspirators and our CDC light traps. So we just looked at all the viruses we collected between 2002 and 2005, and we calculated that the virus, over those years, was experiencing about a little less than one genetic change per 1,000 bases each year. A respectable rate of evolution for a virus. But then we said, well, we can do this within a year. So let's look at 2005. And between July 21st and October 4th, 2005, we were able to calculate the rate of evolution of the virus then at approximately 10 times higher than it was when we looked across years. So I'll give you our interpretations, although this is really the topic of our ongoing research. We certainly know that this virus varies on very fine spatial and temporal scale. Viral evolution happens on a micro scale. We found higher genetic diversity in these residential areas than in the natural areas, which was paradoxical. We found higher evolutionary rates during the summer months within 1 year than between years. And we think this might be a reflection of effects of small-scale environmental differences like temperature. There are these things called urban heat islands, where places like residential sites with impermeable surfaces and asphalt are actually 2 to 3 degrees hotter on average than these natural areas. And this may have led to higher diversity of the virus in these small, hot areas due to increased transmission or higher mutation rates, which would jive, in a sense, with our observation of faster evolution during the hot summer months than between years. So we're testing these with a combination of lab and field experiments. But I guess the take-home message is that this is really the first documented example of a link between urbanization, a recent human change to the environment, and viral evolution. And it's made us wonder, how might things like climate change or increasing urbanization alter the evolution of viruses? We hear a lot about urbanization and climate change altering the distribution of diseases, tropical diseases moving north, things like that, but might we actually be imposing new selective pressures on the pathogens that get here and making them turn into new and perhaps unwelcome forms? So in general, and that's my little cartoon of viral evolution because I couldn't find a better one, viruses like West Nile evolve in real time, in weeks to years, versus the millennia we tend to think of for large charismatic organisms like chimps. And small genetic changes can lead to large changes in the ability of viruses to survive or replicate. And viruses can evolve and adapt in response to environmental changes on very, very fine spatial and temporal scales, again, kilometers or weeks. So I guess it's satisfying to me to know that Darwin had an awful lot to say about viruses, even though he didn't know that they actually existed. So I'll end there except to acknowledge everybody who helps in this work and open it up for a question or two. Yeah, we have data from, continuous data from 2004 to 2008, and every year is the same.
So they're all like up around the 8 somewhere? So
yeah.
Really, okay, so it does come down to area being the difference.
No, it seems like every summer, the rate of evolution of the virus ramps up, and then when you compare it between years, it's lower. It's a little paradoxical, but it seems like the virus kind of stalls out between years, which isn't surprising because it's not being transmitted in the north here during the winter time. Right now, we don't even know really where the mosquitoes are harboring the virus. We think that they're living in warm sewer systems and things like that and just kind of sitting there waiting to come out in the spring when the birds come.
There are many areas in and around Chicago that are hotspots for a lot of illnesses because there are clusters of people whose immune system are compromised because of a lot of chemical industries, dioxin contamination, PCB contamination. Did you factor that into your research?
Yeah, so we didn't look specifically at chemical contaminants, but the one thing I can tell you that's interesting is that The built environment is very important for determining these hotspots. And what seems to be the case, what seems to be explaining why this particular area of suburban Chicago is a problem, is not chemicals, but architecture. Chicago was built out from Lake Michigan, and when the houses were built in the 50s and 60s, they used a particular type of drainage system that required a particular type of storm drain that just by chance happens to be a perfect mosquito breeding habitat. So it's an example of us doing it to ourselves through incomplete understanding of disease ecology. And I should just say that it doesn't take too much of a difference in temperature that one might expect from, say, global climate change to turn Milwaukee into Chicago climatologically. So some of these problems that we've been studying there might be good models for the future of this area unless we do something about it.
Thanks very much, Tony.